From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. And there is news today out of the Supreme Court, which has issued a narrow ruling in favor of a Colorado baker who had refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple because of his religious beliefs. The court sided with the baker 7-2. Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor were the only dissenters in the case. The decision overturns a lower court ruling, but it is still unclear if there will be any broader implications. Emily Bazelon is staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. She's also a fellow at the Yale Law School. Emily, thanks for coming on the show. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. So, you know, this case involved a baker, Jack Phillips, who refused to create a custom wedding cake for two gay men, David Mullins and Charlie Craig. This was back in 2012. How is this being seen? Is the ruling a win for religious freedom?
Well, the ruling is a win for the baker. So Jack Phillips won. But it's a really narrow, kind of carefully crafted ruling in which Justice Kennedy, who writes for the majority, is saying Colorado law can protect gay people from being denied service on the basis of sexual orientation, but the state has to act scrupulously in a manner that's respectful to religious beliefs. And so it's all about the record below and whether this state civil rights commission was sufficiently respectful.
I have his quote here, and I want to read it because I think it's illuminating. He said, "These disputes must be resolved with tolerance, without undue disrespect to sincere religious beliefs, and without subjecting gay persons to indignities when they seek goods and services in an open market." But how do you interpret what he's saying there? Is he trying to give something to both sides?
Yeah, I think he is. I mean, Justice Kennedy is very concerned about dignity, and he is the author of the decisions allowing for marriage equality that we have. He cares about gay rights, but he also cares about respecting people's religious beliefs. And I would say that there's a kind of exquisite sensitivity to respect for religion here. A few comments by commissioners on the Colorado Civil Rights Commission really turned the case and turned Justice Kennedy against the state's enforcement of its civil rights law.
You said it's very narrow. So does the ruling mean anything for, say, a florist or a photographer who has a religious objection to working at a same-sex wedding?
Not really. I mean, this case is going to not create a whole lot of guidance for lower courts. And it really, these questions are still going to come down to the particular facts in a state. Does a state have a law that protects gay people against discrimination? Does a state have a different kind of law that kind of goes an extra mile and protects religious beliefs, allows religious people to do things because of religious objections that otherwise would be unconstitutional? Those are the kind of interplay here. And this case, because it was so narrow and the majority doesn't really say what could happen under a better set of enforcement facts, we just don't really know how it applies.
So have we heard anything from gay rights groups or religious freedom advocates about this? Are they sort of unsure how to feel about it?
Gay rights groups are disappointed, and I think the reason is that they were hoping for a clean decision that said, look, if you are a gay customer walking into a store that's open for a business and you ask for wedding services, you get them, just like everyone else. They didn't get that here. And, you know, people who care more about religious beliefs feel like, well, good, the baker won. It's sort of a kind of half victory on that side. And there have also been interesting calls by liberal groups for a national law that protects LGBTQ people from discrimination. We still don't have that. And that's one reason why there's some question marks left in this case.
Yeah. Well, the Supreme Court ruled in another case today about an undocumented teenager who was in government custody who ended up getting an abortion last fall. What can you tell us about that case?
Well, this is a case in which this teenager came to the United States, discovered she was pregnant and wanted to get an abortion. And the Trump administration was blocking her from doing that, saying that it was, in effect, her guardian and didn't want to do anything that would facilitate this abortion. So the ACLU sued on her behalf and won in front of the D.C. Circuit. And then the Justice Department for the Trump administration did something very unusual. They filed a brief accusing the ACLU of very serious professional misconduct in the way this girl's abortion was perceived. And so what the Supreme Court did today was to dismiss that complaint and not get into, you know, essentially say that, like, we're not going to accuse the ACLU of misconduct here.
All right. Emily Bazelon, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the leaders of the group of seven leading industrialized nations are meeting this week in Canada, and President Trump's decision to slap tariffs on steel and aluminum from allies, including Canada and the European Union, is already top of mind. Yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was unequivocal in his response to the tariffs, which the Trump administration says are being put in place because of threats to U.S. national security.
The idea that, you know, our soldiers who had fought and died together on the beaches of World War II and the mountains of Afghanistan and have stood shoulder to shoulder in some of the most difficult places in the world that are always there for each other, somehow this is insulting to them. The idea that we are somehow a national security threat to the United States is quite frankly insulting and unacceptable.
Joining us from Ottawa is the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's Evan Dyer. Evan, welcome.
Thanks.
And I was in Quebec over the weekend, and the headline in one of the newspapers was, C'est la guerre commerciale. It's the trade war. How angry are Canadians and Canadian officials about this?
Well, I mean, I guess we heard the tone of voice of Justin Trudeau there, and you would have to know how he was. Prior to this, he was all about sunny ways, catching more flies with honey. You know, some of the trade officials that Canadian officials have been dealing with, Robert Lighthizer, Wilbur Ross, they don't go out of their way to be polite, but their Canadian counterparts have been trying to be polite and positive. But Trudeau said that he told Donald Trump in the phone call just before this tariff exemption was listed that this would be a turning point in Canada-U.S. relations. And I think that we have seen that. And the talk about things like Afghanistan, 9/11, shows that the anger is partly over the pretext. It's the national security threat language that has really upset the government here, and I think a lot of ordinary people, because, you know, we heard Trudeau say, for example, do you remember 9/11 when there were 4,000 flights in the air and the U.S. closed its airports because they might have hijackers on them? And all of those planes were landed in Canada and people took the passengers into their homes. And then we went into Afghanistan. So how is it suddenly we became a national security threat? And I think that that's the thing that has driven the anger, that pretext. You know, Trump wasn't popular here to begin with, but this has not helped.
Well, what is the response from Canada going to be when it comes to retaliatory tariffs?
Well, we've seen a list of things that are going to be hit back. It's a $16.6 billion list. It includes steel and aluminum, which is, of course, what Canada got hit with. But there's also a lot of other consumer products and so on. And they're quite targeted in a way to affect industries in particularly sensitive areas in terms of the U.S. midterms, in terms of swing states. Orange juice, for example, is on the list with Florida in mind. We see lawnmowers, and this is probably targeting the Taro Company in Wisconsin, which is considered to be it's in a district that's important in the midterms. Whiskey, the Europeans went for that too. Bourbon, Kentucky, home of Mitch McConnell, but also a state that's seen as part of Trump land, if you like. So there's a targeting of tariffs. There's even hamburgers and ketchup and mustard and hair lacquer, which some people thought might be a sly dig at Donald Trump himself. We don't know about that. But certainly it's a list that goes right across food, you know, mechanical products, plywood, toilet paper, handkerchiefs, dishwasher, detergent, plastic bags.
Wow.
A lot of stuff.
Yeah. Well, and President Trump has been tweeting about this today and says that Canada already has all sorts of trade barriers on U.S. agricultural products. Is that true?
Well, Canada does indeed, under NAFTA, have a carve-out for its dairy and poultry industries where there's a sort of a very traditionally protected industry, similar to the way sugar is protected in the United States, which was also accepted when NAFTA was signed. But, you know, we have to look at the balance of trade in agriculture, which favors the United States. It's the U.S. sells $24 billion of agricultural products to Canada. Canada sells $22. So there's a $2 billion surplus in favor of the United States, exactly as there is with steel, same $2 billion surplus, which makes people here wonder why that kind of trade is a problem. You know, Canada buys a lot of products just because of our climate from the U.S., like lettuce, for example. There's a big lettuce scare going on right now. People have died, but that lettuce is still crossing the border. And I think that Canadians have become used to eating U.S. berries and drinking U.S. orange juice. It's a longstanding and very balanced trade.
And the leaders of the G7 countries are going to have a summit starting on Friday. What's on the agenda there?
Well, it certainly wasn't going to be tariffs. It's about things like climate change, the jobs of the future, gender equality. Actually, when you look at the things it's supposed to be about, you can see, again, a pretty sharp division between President Trump and his administration and the other six members. I mean, climate change, jobs of the future, for example. When you look at the attempt to revive coal, you can see a pretty wide divergence there. But, you know, although tariffs are not on the official agenda, there's no doubt that they are going to be a major item of discussion. This meeting has been put far off in the boonies to prevent protests. But I think that what we're going to see instead is protests from the officials, the leaders that have been invited to it. And actually, some people here are wondering if President Trump will show, given that he tends not to like face-to-face confrontation. From what we've seen in the past, he didn't show up at the Summit of the Americas a couple of months ago. It may be that we see Mike Pence or someone else instead.
That's the CBC's Evan Dyer joining us from Ottawa. Evan, thank you.
Thanks very much.
There have been five mass extinctions in the history of the world, the most famous being the one that wiped out the dinosaurs. But the Permian mass extinction was even more deadly. 96% of the life on Earth died. Peter Brannon is a science journalist who studies these extinctions. He's written the book The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. His book is just out in paperback this month. I spoke with him last year and asked him about the fact that past mass extinctions have involved rapid climate change and carbon in our atmosphere.
I think there's been, at least in the popular imagination, there's this understanding that mass extinctions are what happens when asteroids hit the planet. And I think there's been this really cool story over the past few decades from the paleontology and geology community where they've looked for evidence of asteroid impacts at all the mass extinction levels. And except for the one that we know about when the dinosaurs go extinct, all the mass extinctions seem to have a lot to do with these giant ocean and climate changes that are driven by carbon dioxide. So, you know, in the first mass extinction a long time ago, it seems like there was an ice age from falling CO2. And then in some of the other mass extinctions, it seems like there's extreme global warming and ocean acidification and some of the same stuff we see going on today, driven by carbon dioxide.
And in the past, that carbon dioxide is coming not from cars and factories, but from volcanoes.
Right. So as one paleontologist put it to me, it doesn't matter whether carbon dioxide comes from Volvos or volcanoes. The atmosphere and the ocean responds the same way. But yeah, these are really extreme volcanic events. They're called continental flood basalts. But what happens is basically the Earth kind of opens up in some part of the world, and you just have these floods of lava for thousands of years. But the lava isn't what's killing most of life on Earth because it only covers a certain area. But you see stuff going extinct all over the planet. And it's actually thought that the gases that come up with these volcanoes, most notably CO2, is what's driving the mass extinction. So that's something is kind of alarming,
We talk about a mass extinction, does that mean everything on Earth dies?
The mass extinctions are really five times where over 75% of complex life goes extinct in what geologically is a really quick period of time. So tens of thousands of years at the most, and maybe much quicker than that.
One of the things you point out in this book is that a warning sign for a mass extinction involves the coral reefs being in trouble in the oceans. Tell us about that. When has that happened in the past? Because it is something that is starting to happen now.
Right, yeah. So that's definitely one of the more alarming things is that there have really only been these things called reef collapses a few times in the entire history of animal life. And, you know, oftentimes they're associated with these mass extinctions. So there's this time, the end Triassic mass extinction, where 75% of life went extinct. And coral reefs had this amazing sort of blossoming in the end of the Triassic. And then, you know, they make up a lot of the Austrian Alps. If you hike up those mountains, you can kind of see that they're just made of coral reefs.
Really?
Yeah. And at the end of the Triassic, coral reefs basically disappear completely for millions of years. Too much CO2, when it reacts with seawater, it makes the water more acidic, it makes it warmer, and it makes it really difficult for things like coral reefs to stick around. And so when we plot out what humans are doing for the next few decades, coral reefs are really going to have a hard time sticking around in the second half of this century. And given that that's only happened a few times in Earth's history, that's really pretty amazing that humans have that influence.
And we're already seeing that in places like the Great Barrier Reef right now as ocean temperatures rise just a little bit.
Right. So the Great Barrier Reef has had this really dramatic die-off in only the past year, actually. There was a really bad episode of it. And that's from warming. So modern coral reefs also don't like when it gets warm. But then when you make the water more acidic, too, that's just another stress. And so when we look at what that's going to look like by 2050, unless we get our emissions under control, this is really just a glimpse of the future, unfortunately.
When we look back at the past mass extinctions, do they happen quickly or do they take hundreds, thousands, millions of years to take place?
Yeah, so I think this is kind of an urgent question to address because it's hard to sort of see with high resolution in the fossil record things that happened hundreds of millions of years ago. So maybe these are good analogs for the near future, or maybe these things really do take thousands of years. I think that's something we're trying to figure out. You know, some people would tell you that the dinosaurs were wiped out in 15 minutes in a really bad day, and other people would say that it was sort of this more prolonged thing where ecosystems were stressed by a lot of things, and then the asteroid and these crazy volcanoes in India. It might have been a more prolonged episode that lasted thousands of years. So I think we need to get a better handle of how quickly these things can happen.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Peter Brannon, whose book is called The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. Peter Brannon, in order to do the research for this book, you went all over the country to places that many people don't realize are historical artifacts of what happened in some of these mass extinctions.
Right. So, I mean, for example, one place I went was Cincinnati, which apparently is one of the most fossil-rich regions in the entire world. Just if you pull over on the side of the highway, there's this sort of gray-layered rock that if you go up to it, it's filled with just sea life. Seashells are falling out of the side of the highway in Cincinnati. And this is from 445 million years ago when North America was sort of rotated on its side and south of the equator for the most part, and there was no life on land, and there are all these weird sort of horseshoe crab-looking things in the ocean. So it's this totally different world that exists just on the side of the highway. Another place is the Palisades in New York, which are these giant cliffs made out of basalt that I'd seen a million times visiting New York, but I had no idea that they were part of this sort of magma from one of the worst mass extinctions ever. And you can find the same rock in Nova Scotia and Brazil and Spain. And it's one of these sort of crazy, almost global volcanic events that almost ended life on Earth. So yeah, I mean, there are these mundane places. You've seen them a million times, but the story of geology is really that we're standing on this, you know, underneath our feet are these totally different worlds that once you see through the sort of lens of geology, it kind of changes your perspective on everything.
Well, and now today we think of the Appalachian Mountains as the smaller mountain range
right.
in the United States. But you write that back in the day, they would have been as tall as the Alps.
Oh, yeah. They would have been these towering snow-covered peaks that would have stretched from, Greenland to Alabama. So they are this epic mountain chain, and they just have the misfortune of having been around for a long time. So they've been eroded away. But yeah, they're not just the sort of hills we see, but the months were much more grand than that.
All right, so now let's get back to the catastrophe at hand,
sure.
which is how close are we now to something like what has happened in the past? We know that we are producing a lot of carbon into the atmosphere.
Yeah, so far the damage humans have caused in the environment hasn't actually been through climate change or ocean acidification I was talking about before, but it's actually been through direct interaction with the environment, hunting, fishing, habitat destruction, deforestation, that sort of thing.
Basically, any time that humans in history have shown up in a place, a lot of other species end up dying pretty quickly.
Right, yeah. So if you plot whenever, certainly in the Pacific Islands in the last few hundred years, all these local bird species and things go extinct when humans show up. And in Australia and in North America, it seems like there's this pretty solid coincidence in time between when humans first show up, when all these giant sort of ice age animals go extinct. And then up to the present day, when we're really sort of now with industrial fishing trawlers and things like that, we're sort of accelerating our influence on the environment. But the good news is that there's a lot of biodiversity still to save. Certainly, we've had an incredibly destructive influence on the environment. But I think typical estimates for how many species we've driven extinct is documented less than 1%. Maybe it's a few percent at the most. And these mass extinctions we're talking about, upwards of 75%, sometimes 90% of species go extinct. So we're not there yet, which is the good news, but we really only have a few decades to sort of right the ship because we see that populations in animals are declining all over the world and range sizes are sort of contracting. And that's sort of the first indicator that a species might be about to go extinct is big population decline. So if you project that forward a few centuries, then we might actually be in the same conversation is these crazy events that really only happen once every 100 million years or so.
And what about on the issue of carbon emissions? How close are we to trouble there?
So we know that sometimes you hear a sort of climate denier people say, oh, it's been warm in Earth's past and life was happy, which is true. But the problem is for life that when you change things really quickly, sometimes it can't respond in time. And certainly when you have society with buildings and highways. If life needs to migrate, if it gets really warm, we might be blocking those migration routes. And so maybe we're making it much more difficult for animals and plants to adapt if climate does change really dramatically.
I have to say, after reading this book, that I wonder if there's much that we can do, or if these things are just so much bigger than what humans can do to fix the problems.
Yeah, so certainly we need to transform our energy system in the next decade or two. There's an incredible challenge that there's reason to be skeptical whether humans can do that. But there's other steps we can take. We know that if you just let life sort of have a chance to bounce back, it's incredibly resilient. So a couple decades ago, you weren't supposed to eat swordfish because we almost fished it to extinction. And now we've let swordfish rebound and their stocks are healthy again. And there is a movement towards setting aside more of nature for protected areas. George W. Bush notably set aside the biggest marine protected area at the time. So it shouldn't be a political issue. It hasn't always been a political issue. And I think it's a shame that environmentalism and stewardship of the planet has become one. And hopefully we can move away from that.
Can we avoid another mass extinction?
I think we can. Unless we just stick our head in the sand and do things exactly the same way we've been doing it for the last 50 to 100 years, I think we can. In my better moods, I'm hopeful about humanity's ability to learn and adapt to the changing world around them.
That's Peter Brannon, whose book is called The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. This was fun.
We spoke last August. The book is out in paperback this month.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Wildfire season in the parched southwestern United States is underway. And in northern New Mexico, there's a massive blaze at Ute Park. It's destroyed several buildings and forced hundreds of people from their homes. Sandra Lopez is the public information officer with the state's Type 1 incident management team, which responds to wildfires. Sandra, can you be our eyes on the ground there? What are you seeing at the scene of that fire?
So yesterday we had some wetting rains that came through the area, and it did slow the progression of the fire and it cooled the temperatures of the fire. But today what I'm seeing is a drying trend. It's going to be hot again. We're anticipating some winds, and we know that with hot and dry, that's going to start to have some active fire activity.
And we hear there are hundreds of firefighters working this fire. It is a 36,000-acre blaze. Just describe how big the job has been to try to get this fire under control.
The complexity of the fire itself, it's burning in a terrain where we have mixed vegetation. Some of it is within the grass area, and some of it is within pinyon juniper and mixed conifer. So that means that those trees, they hold heat within them. So when the rain comes through, although it cools and can put out the fire in some of the grass vegetation, it will not within those trees because the trees hold the heat. So it's a complex fire, and we're going to put firefighters where we're able to do so safely to engage directly on the fire to suppress.
I know a handful of buildings have been destroyed. There have been some evacuations of people who are living nearby as well, but is anybody in danger at this point?
Right now, there's a mandatory evacuation for Cimarron, and those individuals, there's an evacuation center that's set up at the Raton Convention Center. And then also for Eagle's Nest, there's also an evacuation center that's set up at the community center.
This is wildfire season. A fire like this is expected, but we have been reporting on the drought conditions that are there where you are in New Mexico. It's already been a very warm, very dry spring. How concerned are you in the coming weeks and months ahead as this fire season continues with other fires popping up in the area?
So yesterday, with those wetting rains that came through, we also had thunderstorm cells that brought lightning. So we're anticipating that there could be some new fire starts today. Here in the southwest area of the country, Arizona and New Mexico, we really did not have a winter. We sort of went from summer straight to spring and right into summer. We did not get a lot of moisture here, So we are in drought conditions, and it's extremely important that people come out to recreate in our national forests and our national parks, that they are diligent with ensuring that they're adhering to any sort of fire restrictions that we have in place or any closures. Mm. We are currently doing closures earlier than we normally do, and that is because we just, our conditions here are just ripe for the smallest spark to start the largest wildfire.
But this is why you train, and I'm sure that for you there is a certain amount of adrenaline that you feel going into a season like this.
There's a lot of adrenaline, but there's a lot of dedication. In order for all of our firefighters and our fire support personnel, we really come from all walks of life. We come from local, state, and federal agencies to come together to ensure that we're able to have the right resources at the right place at the right time to ensure that we're able to suppress a wildfire safely.
That's Sandra Lopez at the scene of the Ute Park fire in northern New Mexico. Sandra, good luck. Be safe.
Thank you.
California holds primary elections tomorrow, and among other things, voters in Santa Clara County will decide whether to recall Judge Aaron Persky. 2 years ago, Persky sentenced Brock Turner, a 19-year-old Stanford University swimmer who was found guilty of sexually assaulting an intoxicated and unconscious woman outside a frat party, to 6 months in jail. Some thought that sentence was too lenient and launched an effort to recall Judge Persky, but not everyone supports the recall. Margaret Russell, who's a law professor at Santa Clara University, is against it. She joins us now. Margaret, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And a lot of people were outraged by Judge Persky's sentence for Brock Turner. They felt it was too lenient, that the judge may have favored Turner because he was a white male university athlete. That's what sparked this recall campaign. The judge says the sentence was lawful. What was your initial reaction to that sentence?
I certainly understand why there was outrage. That was 2 years ago. I think the impetus for our no recall energy, particularly in the last 6 months, has been that outrage cannot be the basis of a wise recall or decision-making process. There have to be more facts. There has to be more of a structure of analyzing the issues.
Are you saying that there would be a situation in which you would support the recall of a judge?
California, as you know, is one of the few states that does have a judicial recall system. It hasn't been used in over 80 years. And under the California Constitution, it is described very generally. So there are no specific criteria. The other side says that that means that whenever somebody wants to recall a judge, they have the right to recall the judge as long as they get enough signatures to put it on the ballot. Well, it's our position that judges should not be recalled for decisions that are lawful, even if they are controversial, because the judicial branch is a separate, independent branch of government. So if I were ever to support a judicial recall in this state, I would look at criteria such as violating the law. I would look at misconduct. I would look at incompetence in terms of inability to perform the duties of the office. And Judge Persky has been, his record has been really raked over the coals, but also examined quite rigorously by several bodies, including the Commission on Judicial Performance. And no one has found misconduct or bias of any sort.
The Stanford law professor who is leading the recall campaign, that would be Michelle Dauber, says Judge Persky has a history of what she sees as bias in cases of sexual assault and violence against women, particularly where the perpetrator is an athlete or otherwise privileged in some way. So she sees a pattern with this judge.
And that is not true. And I have to say that this is the problem with taking one case, such as the Turner case, and then building a narrative around that case. At the time, the Turner case was the source of the recall movement. Since then, they have, we think, cherry-picked five cases or so out of the 20,000 cases that Judge Persky has heard over his years, in which there have never been any complaints registered by the district attorney, by the public defenders, and instead created a narrative about those cases, those five cases, that upon investigation, we have found to be not true. And we've explained that on our website and our materials. And in fact, even a newspaper that wound up endorsing the recall said that they found that argument unpersuasive.
The Santa Clara County District Attorney, Jeffrey Rosen, is also opposed to the recall. He worked to get a law passed that makes sexual assaults like the one Brock Turner committed punishable with a mandatory sentence of 3 years in prison. Do you think mandatory sentencing for sexual assault crimes is a good idea?
I do not. And that is part of an overall belief that I have, that mandatory minimums remove the discretion that judges really need to craft solutions that hold defendants accountable without prescribing ahead of time rigid solutions.
Do you think that if Judge Persky is recalled, that people are going to look at this from the outside and say, this is about the Me Too movement?
Well, you know, that remains to be seen, obviously, and some people will do that. But I think there's also a very strong trend that we need to pay attention to, and it is this, that before the publicity about Me Too, of course, there have always been wrongs against women, and it is very important to address them. But the development of getting rid of judges because you think they are soft on crime, that's a pretty old ploy, and it's a very regressive one. That really concerns me because, as Ruth Bader Ginsburg and many others have said, the independent courts are really a crown jewel of our democracy, and democracies die when you start treating judges like political pawns in a prize fight. They represent a process and a fair process, and they should not promise any conclusion in any case.
So what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I have to say, we are the underdog. We have been working very hard because they spent a year and a half gathering signatures for the ballot, and I am hopeful that we are continuing to turn the tide, but I do think it's going to be close.
That's Margaret Russell, who is a law professor at Santa Clara University in California. She is against the recall of Judge Aaron Persky. We'll find out what happens tomorrow. Margaret Russell, thank you.
Thank you.
Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is one of the most hyped baseball players in the country right now. He's the son of soon-to-be Hall of Famer Vlad Sr. and is playing third base for the minor league New Hampshire Fisher Cats this season. He's generating a lot of national attention while giving New Hampshire baseball fans a preview of a potential superstar. New Hampshire Public Radio's Todd Bookman reports.
Even casual baseball fans have probably heard about Vlad Jr. by now. The 19-year-old hits baseballs hard.
He's the best hitter I've seen come through the minor leagues in my 17 years in baseball. Born to hit, man.
That's John Schneider, manager of the Fisher Cats, a minor league affiliate for the Toronto Blue Jays. Most AA ball clubs can fly under the radar when they travel. With Guerrero on the roster, this one can.
Yeah, no doubt. We show up at hotels at midnight and there's like 50 people waiting for our bus. You know, we're like a boy band. That's what I say. It's like, you know, who are you waiting for? Oh, I guess that guy.
A baseball boy band. But instead of Tiger Beat or Tumblr, Vlad Jr. is getting mentions in the New York Times and on popular sports blogs like Deadspin and ESPN. Speaking through an interpreter just after batting practice, Guerrero, who's Dominican, says off the field he's living a very non-rock star life in New Hampshire. His grandmother cooks for him, though he occasionally heads out for a bite of Caribbean food. Otherwise, it's all baseball. He's just trying to get better.
En todo, yo necesito mejor en todo.
He said that he have to work on everything. He just come over here and try to work everything, hitting and defense as well.
Guerrero may have inherited his dad's talent, but he's a different player. While Vlad Sr. was long and lean in right field, Jr. is shorter, more muscular, and plays third. His chin-length dreadlocks sneak out from under his cap. While understated with the media, Guerrero's stats right now are otherworldly. He's hitting over 400, and he's reached base in nearly all games this year.
Thank you very much, Ben. Fisher Cats fans, welcome to Northeast Delta Dental Stadium on a glorious Tuesday evening. As we get
for the first pitch at a recent game, fans leaned over the railing and asked for an autograph. Eric Beauchamp from Quebec was among them.
Oh, we're here just for Vlad. He's phenomenal.
Beauchamp was able to get his Vlad jersey autographed. If you want your own Vlad shirt, good luck. Fisher Cats merchandise manager Sam Stowarts.
So we've been out for a week now. I just can't keep them on the shelves.
Number 27 jerseys are selling out. The games are not. Midweek in May against the Portland Sea Dogs, there's just a few thousand fans in attendance. Not exactly how legends are made.
Now batting the third baseman, Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
All right, bottom of the third, game tied at two. Vlad comes to bat with his teammate Bo Bichette, the son of another famous major leaguer, Dante Bichette, on third base. The big righty gets into one. A drive to deep left center. The ball just keeps soaring back, back, back. It's over the wall. Michael Elkovich comes to a lot of Fisher Cats games. He's seen plenty of hot prospects like Guerrero play here, but fail to find success in the big leagues.
It's hard to say. When you're hitting as well as he is, yeah, maybe. But then, of course, you get to the major leagues, and all of a sudden, you never know what's going to happen. I hope he's ready. I hope he stays for a lot longer, though.
Guys who hit like this, they don't tend to stick around Manchester, New Hampshire for all that long. For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman.
Apple CEO Tim Cook is announcing new features today that could help people use their iPhones less often. Now, it sounds counterintuitive, but Apple and other smartphone companies are responding to criticism that their products are addictive and get in the way of other important things like human interaction and sleep. Google released a function for Android last month that lets you set a time limit for certain apps. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he's been following this on his new podcast, Crazy Genius. Derek, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Sure. So tell us more about some of the tools that these companies have been offering, like Apple, and are they going to help in any substantive way?
Well, you mentioned Apple, you mentioned Google's Android, and there's also Samsung, which has partnered with Arianna Huffington to offer a Thrive Global app, which essentially does the same thing. It offers a dashboard of the apps that you've spent time with on your phone, and then even allows a way for you to put your phone essentially on a mode, something like an airplane mode called Thrive Mode, where when people email you or text you, the app texts them back and says, don't bother me. It's the equivalent, I suppose, of a do not disturb sign on your hotel door. I think it's really interesting and kind of cool that these companies that are clearly in the business of selling phones, of keeping you on your device, are offering some tools to at least inform you of how you're using the device, because that information certainly has to be the first step toward using your device in a smarter manner. Now, whether they're going to offer anything more substantive than that, I don't know.
What does the evidence say? I'm sure people are doing a lot of research about this, about these phones, which I have gripped in my hand right now, by the way, about how addictive they are and how they impact our daily lives.
I am now gripping my phone as well in solidarity with you, Peter. So this is really early days in the research. And as a result, as with all new research, the research is a little bit all over the place. There are some studies that suggest that, for example, spending time on social media, if you're a teenage girl, raises your odds of displaying signs of depression by 70%. Mm. And yet there are other studies that seem to suggest that the effects of social media and smartphone usage are no more dangerous than eating potatoes. And in fact, I just ate a potato for lunch. And then I looked at social media. So theoretically, neither of those things should have been very dangerous. So again, I think it's really important to say there are a lot of people studying this. There are a lot of reports that listeners are going to read in the news that say that smartphones and social media are addictive. That may be the case, but it's early days in the research.
All right. You talked about this internet addiction, smartphone addiction on your podcast. You spoke with NYU psychology professor Adam Alter, who said he believes these companies are, in fact, trying to make addictive products. Let's listen to that.
People asked me, are these companies just making the best products possible, or are they making products that are designed to addict? And the answer very clearly from behind the curtain is, we are trying to addict you. We are trying to hook you.
Derek, you say it's great that these companies are doing this, but I mean, are they really being altruistic when they're trying to come up with these tools to limit our use of their products? When, by the way, they're like having this big conference in California today, Apple is trying to unveil all the other cool technology that's supposed to bring you into their products even more.
Yeah. You don't have to sell me on skepticism. I am always going to be default skeptical when any company says that it's working to make its product less useful, less compulsive. So yes, of course, I think we should take all of this with a grain of salt and believe Adam Alter and people like him when they say that smart smartphones and social media have taken a page out of the gambling casino playbook and found ways to make their product compulsive. And indeed, right now, the only behavioral addiction that exists in the DSM-5 is gambling addiction. Mm. And so the thinking with smartphone addiction is that it is going to be potentially the next behavioral addiction entered into that Bible of psychiatry. That said, look, every, you know, to quote the cliche, every journey of 1,000 miles has to begin with a single step. And that single step that you have Apple and Google and Samsung, some of the smartest, some of the largest tech companies in the world taking right now, are at least offering dashboards to show us how we use our phones. So if we want to curb our usage, we have the information to do so.
And look, industry is responding in another way. There's this new product called a Light Phone 2, and frankly, it doesn't work very well. There's no color on the screen. There's no social media. It's called the phone that actually respects you. So, I mean, I don't know if it's going to – I think that sounds like a great idea, but the actual – you know, the chance of me going to the store and buying one seems kind of low.
No, this does seem like the sort of product that is made in order to be written about by tech journalists rather than the sort of product that is made to be bought by actual consumers. That said, look, I think the big picture here is that we're in the middle of a very important and very uncertain debate about whether or not smartphones and social media are the cigarette of the 21st century. I think the research will ultimately come down closer to smartphones and social media are the junk food or the dubiously healthy food of the 21st century, which is to say, of course, there is a way that you can eat this stuff, consume this stuff so that it helps you, so that it makes you more informed, connects with people at work, connects with family. But there's also a way to abuse it such that you feel a lot of remorse after you spend time with the phone. I hope that these tech companies keep on trying to make us better consumers of their tech.
I have a personal rule. I wait 30 minutes until after I wake up to get on my phone. But anyways, Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. What does that mean, having a potato for lunch? I'm just trying to figure that
out.
Baked potato, I guess. It's Here and Now.